We see stories in the news from time to time about children dying because their parents choose prayer over medicine. Some parents in those situations have faced criminal charges for their actions or inactions and have served time. Today's guest serves up a series of such cases in his book and provides a broader context on the uneasy intersection of religion and medicine. Dr. Paul Offit wrote the book Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. Yes, Dr. Paul Offit is an MD. He works at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where he's chief of the Division of Infectious Diseases and the director of the Vaccine Education Center, all this while he teaches vaccinology and pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. Dr. Offit, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
Can we guess that you've talked to a few reporters about vaccine in the last couple of years?
Just a few.
All right. Tell us about what the general nature of the conversation's been like.
Regarding vaccines? Well, I think this year, frankly, has been a tipping point. You know, with the outbreak, the measles outbreak that centered on Disneyland, I think it's been different. You know, last year we had 650 cases of measles. It really centered on Medina County and an Amish population. There were 385 cases in that population. Media never noticed. Parents never noticed. I think it's because they saw that as a insular community. They saw it as other, but not Disneyland. I think Disneyland people see as a shared space, a commons, and it really made people angry. I frankly never heard a level of anger, at least for some parents, against those who were choosing not to vaccinate their children, putting not only their children but also other children at risk.
You know, from the perspective of somebody who works in Ashland, Oregon, which has one of the highest exemption rates in the country for vaccinations, it seems like we've gotten to perhaps a backlash to a backlash to a backlash. I don't know if you see the same thing from where you sit.
Yeah, I have. It's interesting. You know, people say that vaccines are a victim of their own success, and in that, you know, that certainly my children who are 22 and 20, you know, don't see these diseases anymore, so they're far less compelled by them. And I think that's also true of young doctors. But I think you could argue the anti-vaccine movement is also now a victim of its own success, and that now we're starting to see diseases come back, like measles, which I think is probably the best indicator of the strength of a national immunization program. It's a very effective vaccine, but it's also a very contagious virus. So when herd immunity starts to erode, it's the first one you'll see come back.
Victim of their own success in the sense that people got so used to not having these diseases around, they figured we were okay?
No, I think the anti-vaccine movement has scared people enough away from vaccines that now we're starting to see vaccine-preventable diseases come back.
Mm-hmm. Let's go wider than just vaccines. There are several examples up front of the book, and they're generally medical neglect. I mean, is that the general thrust of what we're seeing here? It's not that people have actively done bad things, but more often than not just haven't done things?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So the book focuses, although primarily on the sort of 25 faith-healing sects, primarily Christian Science in the United States, that choose prayer instead of, say, insulin for diabetes or antibiotics for meningitis. It also focuses on other things like Jehovah's Witnesses' choice not to get blood transfusions. There's also an ultra-Orthodox Jewish circumcision ritual that puts children at risk of disseminated herpes simplex virus that has caused children to die or suffer permanent brain damage. So I go through sort of a number of those things. And frankly, I think the thing that's most upsetting to me is that, for the most part, legally we stand back and let it happen.
Early in the book, you contrast your work with recent books by well-known atheists. You say this is not your point, though.
Yeah, that's the point I would say that surprised me the most in the writing of this book. I mean, I've been influenced by people like Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris, the sort of militant atheists who argue that religion is illogical and potentially harmful. But I just didn't end up there. I mean, first of all, there's too much good that's been done in the name of religion to simply cast it aside. Secondly, I guess as I read through the New Testament and tried to put, you know, the historical Jesus in some sort of context, I sort of came away with exactly the opposite feeling, which is that when one puts their children in harm's way in the name of God or in the name of Jesus, it's a profoundly unchristian thing to do. And in a better world, I think those who represent those religions would stand up and say, this isn't us. I mean, you know, religion teaches us to care about our children, care about our community. When we choose to put them in harm's way unnecessarily, it's not religion and frankly shouldn't be given the legal protections of religion.
Is this sort of like the old parable about the person who was waiting for God to rescue him from the flood and he ignores the boat and the helicopter and all the other things and he gets to heaven and God says, I sent you those things?
That's exactly right. I mean, the line I like is the Galileo line. I can't believe that the same God who gave us sense, reason, and intellect also intended us to forgo their use.
That's a good line. You say medicine, though, is not the hero of the book. So who or what is?
Religion is the hero. I think that I, as I went through the New Testament, just became really impressed by the figure of Jesus as wild as this may sound, I mean, independent of whether you believe in the existence of God, or independent of whether you believe Jesus was the Son of God, or independent of whether you believe that the four Gospels that made it into the final canon are an accurate reflection of Jesus' life or work, because they were written certainly decades after he died, you have to be impressed by the figure described as Jesus of Nazareth in the New Testament. I mean, the time of his life, which was roughly 4 BC to 30 AD, child abuse was the crying vice of the Roman Empire. You know, abandonment was common, infanticide was common. Children didn't matter. You could do whatever you wanted to children, but that wasn't the way that Jesus is described in the New Testament. He stands up for children. My favorite line in the New Testament became, you know, "Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of my brethren, you have done it unto me." I think you could put that on the entranceway of every children's hospital in the world. And so with that, and having gone through the 1991 Philadelphia measles epidemic in our city, which centered on two fundamentalist churches, both of which chose not only not to vaccinate their children, but not to give intravenous fluids for dehydration or oxygen for pneumonia, when those children died, and we had 9 children die in that 3-month period, 5 in a 10-day period, those parents all said the same thing: Jesus was my doctor. And so I just needed to look at that, and I just didn't agree when it was all done.
Dr. Paul Offit, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. You got a taste of what's in the book. We'll talk more about it and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Paul Offit and you in a minute 25. On the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Paul Offit from Philadelphia, talking about religion and medicine and where they meet in his book, Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. Everything from vaccine exemption to faith healing to exorcism all appears in the book and in this discussion as well. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Paul, you just mentioned before we hit the break about the 1991 measles epidemic in Philadelphia that I get the sense that the genesis of this book was at that time. Have you really been working on it since then?
Well, but it was certainly the impetus for the book. I mean, as I sort of lived through that experience and was pretty much scarred by, medicine has limits, obviously. There's much we don't know and much we can't do. But one thing we do know is that the germ theory is not a theory anymore, and that vaccines prevent potentially deadly infections. And these parents chose not only to put their children in harm's way by not vaccinating, but then didn't treat them, chose not to treat them even supportively, when they got sick. They chose prayer instead. And I watched as we struggled, both the public health community and the legislative community, trying to figure out how to deal with this. And it struck me that it was sort of a level of respect for religion that wasn't deserved. Because, when parents, choose to just let their children die of potentially treatable infections, it's just unconscionable. And I just think that's when the line was crossed. And it just scarred me. And that's, I think I always had that in my head when I wrote this book.
Do you get the sense that the civil authorities are very careful and they kind of tiptoe around religious exemptions and things like that?
It's political dynamite. I mean, nobody wants to touch religion. I guess what I'm trying to argue is that if, for example, a sect sprang up in the United States where child sacrifice was part of that sect, I think we would say that's not okay. I'd like to think we step forward and we say this is not okay in this society. When people choose faith healing, when they choose not to give insulin for diabetes or not to give chemotherapy for treatable cancers or not to give antibiotics for meningitis, I don't see that as much different. And we do, for the most part, stand back, because at some part we don't like to tell people how to practice their faith and how they should believe, perfectly reasonable to a point, but I think this is that point.
Let's take a call. We have Jim in Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Paul Offit, the author of Bad Faith.
Good morning. Thank you. My question is, if my children are vaccinated, what is the risk to my children to be around unvaccinated children? Why would I care? Other than that, I don't want to see a kid get sick.
Okay, so your kids are vaccinated, the other ones aren't, and is there a damage to exposure, danger from exposure there, Dr. Paul?
Right, well, like all medical procedures, vaccines aren't 100% effective. So if you take, for example, the measles vaccine, which is highly effective, I mean, if the first dose of measles vaccine essentially confers 95% protection, which is to say 95 of 100 people who get the measles vaccine will be protected, but 5 people won't. So even though you've gotten the vaccine and it's a highly effective vaccine, you may be one of those 5 who isn't protected. So if you're exposed to someone who has measles, then you're at as much risk as if you weren't vaccinated.
Do most vaccines gain intensity with time in this? I mean, I know with flu shots, you're told wait about 2 weeks before it'll reach full strength.
Right. Well, it's true that when you're exposed to any sort of virus or bacteria, it takes about 7 to 10 days really to begin to develop a specific antibody response that would then neutralize that virus or bacteria. That's true.
Okay. So off the vaccines and back onto the more general look at religion and medicine. And you give a fairly lengthy discussion to Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science, which raises the basic question, what led her to seek healing away from doctors in the first place?
Well, I mean, so Mary Baker Eddy wrote the major text of her Religion, Science, and Health in 1875. Medicine didn't have much to offer then. I mean, you had quinine to treat malaria, you had ether and chloroform as general anesthetics, but not much else. And so what she did, I think, that was her brilliance in some ways, was she put into the hands of the people the power to heal, the belief that if you prayed and prayed hard enough and were close enough to God, that you could heal. And at that time, you know, it became, frankly, one of the fastest growing religion in the late 1800s. But very quickly we developed antibiotics. We developed anti-seizure medicines. We understood that the germ theory wasn't a theory anymore. And now medicine has far more to offer than we did, 125, 135 years ago. So to stick to that faith that you can pray meningitis away or pray bacterial pneumonia away, is obviously ignoring medical advances to the detriment of your child. You know, there was a 1944 ruling in Princeton, Massachusetts that said it best. While you are at liberty to martyr yourself to your religion, you are not at liberty under identical circumstances to martyr your child to your religion. That's where the state has to step in, and I think that's where we have so much trouble drawing the line.
And that was a 1944 case, you say?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what were the circumstances there, and why does it seem like we're still struggling with the issue this many years later?
Right. It was actually a fairly trivial case. It was a Jehovah's Witness parent who wanted to take actually her niece to pamphleteer on the streets of Brockton, Massachusetts at night. It actually violated child labor laws. So it was that sort of clash between the practice of religion and, in this case, a child welfare, a child labor law on the streets of Brockton. And it just happened to be that the justice who wrote for that majority said, this is the phrase that he used. Obviously, sort of went beyond the case in front of him, but that was the phrase that was used.
All right, so it was not a case, though, involving any kind of medical care or that sort of thing.
No, that would help. The only case, really, that's gone to the Supreme Court that's involved that has been Jehovah's Witness cases. So that's gone twice to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has made this very clear. You are not allowed to deny a child life-saving blood transfusion, and that comes up in our hospital periodically. We just make them wards of the courts. We give them blood transfusion, save their life, and then give them back to the parents. It would be of value, actually, if a faith-healing case went to the Supreme Court, you know, like the case that we just saw in our city where, you know, a parent denied their child antibiotics for bacterial pneumonia. They were put on probation. 2 years later, they died denied another child antibiotics for bacterial pneumonia. They basically killed 2 children needlessly, and then, and only then, were their children put in foster care. But, you know, there was plenty of warning that was going to be a problem before that second child died.
You were talking about the Jehovah's Witnesses and the blood transfusions, and I'm struck by it. I'd understood before that Jehovah's Witnesses did not take blood transfusions because it's considered, what, cannibalism or vampirism or something along those lines?
Yeah, it's 2 lines, actually, one in Leviticus, the other in Acts, that have to do with, I shall not partake of the blood of mammals or birds, and they took that to mean this. Obviously, blood transfusions didn't come about till the late 1800s, which was written, which occurred well after, these major texts were written, so it was just their interpretation of that.
But the one of the stories you relate in Bad Faith is about a woman who had a blood transfusion at age 17 to save her life, and yet 4 years later, as an adult, as a married woman, regretted it.
Yeah, that was actually one of the more striking stories. I talked to some of the medical students at Penn State who witnessed that talk. And so this was a woman who was less than 18 years of age, therefore in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, she was still considered a child. She had a severe anemia. She got a blood transfusion against her parents' wishes, because they were Jehovah's Witnesses, and her wishes. It was against her wishes also. And she came back then and talked to a group of first and second year medical students at Penn State, Hershey, and said that while she understands that her life was saved, that her life has no meaning now, that she knew that eternal peace would not be hers, that heaven would not be hers because she received a transfusion, and she really wished that they hadn't done it. And some of those students that walked out of that room were so shaken they really wondered whether they would ever do that again. I mean, such is the power of belief.
Well, and there are lots of other stories in the book that head that way, too, where people went against their religion, even if temporarily, and paid a major price for it. Let's talk about Rita Swan and the circumstances of the death of her child.
Yeah, she's an unlikely hero in my book. She is a mother who was a child of Christian Scientists. She grew up as a Christian Scientist. Her husband was a Christian Scientist. She was brilliant. I mean, she got a PhD in Vanderbilt in English. Her husband a PhD from Vanderbilt in math. They were very, very smart, well-spoken people, but very, I think, unsophisticated about medicine. And when their son, who was 15 months old, had bacterial meningitis, they chose prayer instead of antibiotics, and their child died. Now, these, like many faith-healing parents, love their children. I mean, that's not an issue. If you ask her, why didn't you take him for treatment, she said, because I was treating him, at least what I knew to be treatment, which was prayer. But then I think she opened her eyes, and she went to the Wayne State Medical Library in Detroit and read about bacterial meningitis and taught herself about medicine and realized that she'd been duped, basically. She went on the Phil Donahue show and called a major religion, Christian Science, essentially a fraud. A fragile magic was her term. And she now has made it her mission to try and overturn these religious exemptions to child abuse and neglect law. She's an amazing person, actually. In fact, my royalties, anyway, from the sale of this book are going to go to her organization, which is called Children's Health Care is a Legal Duty, or CHILD.
Bad Faith, When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine is the book we're talking about with its author, Paul Offit, MD, here on the Jefferson Exchange. Join us as we talk about religion and medicine and their collision and the unhappy results that sometimes happen. 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. A couple of surprising things in here, and not just within the history of Christian Science itself, which, as you point out, in 1875, medicine was not in great shape, but the 19th century is also a time of many religions being created, Mormonism among them, in addition to Christian Science. So interesting set of circumstances crossing there. But one of the things I had not realized until I saw it in this book was that Christian Science practitioners can bill for their services and be paid through medical insurance.
That's right. It actually functions very much like a healthcare system. You are trained as a practitioner, which is to say you are trained on how to pray. You're then essentially licensed by the church. And then in the case of Rita Swan, she called actually two separate practitioners who prayed for her son till he died. They charged for their services. In fact, that was reimbursed by the insurance system that they were working under in Michigan. It's also still true through the Affordable Care Act. You can charge and be reimbursed. The one thing that's different is you can never be sued because it's been tried, and the rulings have been, what they are doing, they're practicing their religion, they're not practicing healthcare, although it certainly looks like a healthcare system.
Now, in the end, you think Christian Science is a cult? I mean, like the People's Temple and the Branch Davidians, you pretty much write about them in the same paragraphs.
Yeah, I try and go through, I guess, the Robert Lifton criteria for what's defined to be a cult. And I do think that when you so actively suppress information that is of value to you, that you move into the cult status. I mean, it's sort of this cult of lack of knowledge. I mean, that Rita Swan was specifically instructed, as was her husband, never to learn anything about modern medicine. That was evil, that when you did that, you were really just trying to dethrone God. And I think that sort of lack of that attempt to try and keep people insular, like Jim Jones or David Koresh or Marshall Applewhite at Heaven's Gate, I think that moves into the cult category, yes.
But have you seen different levels of application? And I ask this because my mother-in-law was a Christian Scientist, and so I got to watch her work with things, and it didn't seem quite as much of a banishment of knowledge as the cases in the book seem to make it look like.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, she lived. When you're choosing not to give antibiotics for bacterial infections, especially severe ones, or you're choosing not to give insulin, which is what they're saying. That is the rule of law there with Christian Scientists. I mean, fortunately, your grandmother didn't need to do that. But there are, you know, go to some of these grave sites. I mean, they look like they were transported from the 1600s into the 21st century. There's so many children's graves. But, you know, it's always the adults that do the talking. The children, you know, aren't represented here. I think you can make the same argument for the vaccine story. You know, when you go to these legislative hearings, it's always the adults that are talking about their rights. But who speaks up for the rights of the child?
Let's take a call. We have Jamie in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Paul Offit, the author of Bad Faith.
Yes, good morning, Jeffrey.
Howdy.
Well, Dr. Paul, I don't know if you speak to this in your book or anything like that. Would you compare and contrast the influences of Scientology in regards to mental health? And that's kind of a recent thing, like certain celebrities like Tom Cruise and John Travolta have seemed to be kind of strange when it comes to medical things with regard to the mental health situation. And if it's in your book or anything about that, I'd really like to hear it over the radio, Jeffrey. So,
All right, let's find out.
Let him talk about that.
All right, thanks, Jamie. Appreciate it. So, Paul, is anything like that in your book?
Yeah, thanks, Jamie. I originally had written two pages on Scientology, specifically, as you say, with regard to their dismissal of psychiatry, either psychotherapy or psychoactive drugs for treatments of psychiatric disorders. But I ended up not doing it, mostly because I just had a lot of trouble considering them to be a religion. It's clearly based on, you know, L. Ron Hubbard's Dianetics, which you know, is largely just a science fiction book, and that they've been able to successfully call themselves a church and get the tax breaks the churches get. That's great. Good news. Good luck. Good news to them, for them. But I just couldn't put it into the category of religion. So I ended up taking it out.
And not all the case studies in the book are about religion. You do swing off to Stanley Milgram's experiments in the 60s. What was he trying to find out?
I think he was trying to find out whether or not the way in which we characterized, I guess, Hitler's willing executioners could ever happen anywhere else. We always thought that this could never happen in America, that we would never sort of suppress ourselves to that sort of totalitarianism. And what Milgram found is that, you know, that a guy in a white lab coat standing next to you could make you do things that were directly opposed to, you know, to what would be your ethical, what you consider to be ethical or moral behavior. It was a sort of frightening set of experiments. And
People thought they were delivering electric shocks is what was going on.
That's right. He was making people sort of deliver electric shocks till the person in the other room was screaming and then stopped screaming. And for all you knew, the person could have died, and they still were delivering electric shocks. His point being that if someone told you, you know, that you it's okay, you can continue to do it, you'll continue to do it even if you think it's wrong, you know, which was basically the Nuremberg defense, right? It was, I did what I was told. And that frightened people. The purpose of the describing those experiments in this book is that, you know, to talk about sort of the influence of people who are charismatic leaders and who sort of, you know, tell that how far will you go to do what a charismatic leader tells you to do. In the case of Jim Jones, you'll go to the point that you'll drink the so-called Flavor Aid and give it to your children. And, you know, I think at some level, the point I'm trying to make is that somewhere in us, all of us have the capacity to do this, which is frightening.
Well, and then you move on to the story of Larry and Lucky Parker and their diabetic son. Now, why did they stop giving him insulin in the first place when they had been giving it to him for years?
Yeah, see, they to me represent it's that difficulty in trying to separate out what is a heartfelt religious belief from what is a dangerous delusion. I mean, when do you move into the category where you would call somebody psychotic? What was interesting about Larry Parker is that, first of all, he wrote a book called We Let Our Son Die, which far from being a mea culpa, really was this is an example of how we showed our faithfulness. He was medically sophisticated, which is unusual, I think, for some of these faith-healing groups. He was not part of a faith-healing church. He was part of a mainstream church in Barstow, California. And he understood that what it meant. He'd been giving his son insulin. He understood what it meant to give too much or too little insulin. He was medically quite sophisticated. And then he just decided that he didn't want his son to have this essentially chronic disorder that he would suffer for the rest of his life. So he believed he was faithful to God, and he was going to pray to God and make his son's diabetes go away until his son died from diabetic ketoacidosis. Then he decided he was going to resurrect his son initially at a funeral service, and then ultimately that his son would be resurrected after he was put in the ground. Not surprisingly, none of that happened, and ultimately he and his wife were charged with murder, although, like all faith healers or people who do this, he didn't spend a day in jail and didn't have to, in any sense, give up the care of his other children.
He never spent a day in jail?
Well, he got off. No, he was never sentenced to jail, no.
And yet even the Parker's pastor said Wesley should see a doctor, and the pastor's position came up in court.
Right. So when do you cross the line into being considered psychotic, where you believe you can resurrect your child? When are you considered mad? it's hard because at some level religion at some level is always not based on what we know to follow the laws of nature. Whether it's that Jesus was resurrected or Lazarus was raised from the dead after 4 days, or that Moses parted the Red Sea. We're asked to believe in something above the laws of nature.
Well, much more to talk about. The book is Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. Paul Offit, MD, is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Welcome back and talk more with Paul, and take your phone calls and emails as well if you'd like to join us back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Paul Offit, MD, works at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, teaches at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. He's written a book about the intersection of religion and medicine and some of the unhappy results. The book is called Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. Our phone number is 800-838-3760 throughout the listening area, 800-838-3760, and our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Paul, let's pull back for a macro view. Do you have any idea how many people use prayer instead of medicine?
I think it's fair to say it would be in the tens of thousands, probably in the sort of 50 to 100,000 range.
Right,
it's hard to know because some of these communities are insular, and so you don't have a good sense of them, but it's somewhere in that range.
And the example you gave, the measles outbreak at an Amish community in Ohio that people didn't hear much about, but when the measles outbreak comes from Disneyland, boom, all of a sudden it's mainstream.
Right. Yes, that's right. I'm not sure I would consider the Amish decision not to vaccinate a religious decision. It's much more of a cultural decision, I think. But yeah, I think when we care about it when it affects us, and obviously when people choose not to give their children, say, antibiotics for meningitis, it's really not going to affect us so much. And so maybe that's what makes us willing to stand by it. It's amazing to me. There are two fundamentalist faith healing groups in the city of Philadelphia. One is Faith Tabernacle. The other is First Century Gospel. You know that those two groups are not going to be giving antibiotics for bacterial infections or insulin for diabetes or chemotherapy for cancer. You know that. And yet we stand back and let it happen. And I just think it's unconscionable.
So let's go to that, because they were central to the measles outbreak in 1991 that you said was the impetus for the book. Nobody comes out looking good in this, including the Philadelphia Inquirer, which had the headline, "No Measly Problem," which you took exception to. What was that about?
Right, so it started small, and that's when that first article appeared. When the first couple cases of measles, it was treated as something that was sort of silly and fun. I think because we don't realize that these viruses like measles or chickenpox aren't just simple rites of childhood passage. They can be killers, and certainly we very quickly learned that lesson in Philadelphia. This city was in a panic. There were schools that were canceling trips to the city. We got to the point in the city of Philadelphia that we did something that no one has ever done before or since, which is we had compulsory vaccination, which is to say, eventually those children in those two church groups were compelled by law to be vaccinated, even though there was a religious exemption to vaccination that had been on the book for 10 years. And the ACLU, which is a group perfectly willing to take on popular causes, refused to take that case because they said, echoing the words of that 1944 Supreme Court decision, you're not allowed to martyr your children to your beliefs. And that was certainly true. That I'm not sure that would ever happen again, but that to understand it, you had to be here because it was that bad in this city.
It's pretty shocking, but you do a great job of explaining the difference between compulsory and mandatory. Mandatory, you could say, well, you get this, and if you don't get this, we'll take something away from you. But compulsory means you're getting this shot. And it happened to six kids, was it?
That's right. But it was way too late. I mean, by that time, it was already spring, and measles starts to abate in spring and early summer. So that's what stopped that outbreak, not the few children that we vaccinated far too late.
All right, we started out way back talking about court cases that we see from time to time about parents being tried. I mean, does it seem like it happens fairly often, or is it pretty much a rare thing?
It's a rare, you know, it's interesting. This doesn't happen in Canada and England. The reason is they don't tolerate this kind of faith healing. I mean, if you are found to medically neglect your child in an important way, you will lose your other children and you will go to jail. And so that's been a real disincentive to act that way. And that's the way we did it in this country up until about the mid-1970s, early 1970s, when, ironically, there was something called the Child Abuse Protection and Treatment Act, or CAPT. It was sort of the impetus was Humphrey, but it was passed under Nixon's administration. And there were two prominent Christian scientists in that administration that realized there was about to be an uncomfortable light that was going to be shown on their religion. And so they insisted that you could not get federal funds for child abuse protection and treatment unless you had a religious exemption to child abuse neglect, because they knew that Christian scientists could be, you know, claimed to be, you know, medically neglecting their children. I mean, though, and so for that reason, all 50 states then put in religious exemptions to child abuse and neglect laws. Now, six of them have ultimately scaled back, largely because of the efforts of Rita Swan. Interestingly, those two Christian scientists are names at least older people will recognize. They were Bob Haldeman and John Ehrlichman.
Yeah, one of the two major players in the Nixon White House and all the Watergate doings. Haldeman and Ehrlichman, we were, you know, it sounded like a song and dance routine through the early 70s. We all got to know that name.
Sure.
You clearly take issue with literal interpretations of the Bible, but is that interpretation often selective?
Sure. I mean, I think religion should serve humanity. You know, it should make us more humane. It should make us find that better part of ourselves. I think when religion is used to represent the worst of us, I mean, whether it's misogyny or homophobia or anti-Semitism, whatever, then it's really not religion anymore. And I think we'd be better served if we sort of came to that notion.
But you know, it's not necessarily just the things that should have happened in doctors' offices. I mean, doctors are not going to perform exorcisms, which is isn't that what Ray Hemphill got arrested for?
That's right. Yes. So you know, first of all, the Catholic Church in 2005 had an exorcism training course in Baltimore, and about 100 priests and bishops showed up. So, I mean, exorcism is still to some extent practiced in the Catholic religion. It's not common, but it happens. And there was a death associated with exorcism at a church a number of years ago with a little boy who was autistic, and you know, they tried to drive the devil out of him by leaning on his chest with this man's knee, and ultimately he died of mechanical asphyxiation.
Really? So just they forced the air out of the kid's chest, and that was that?
Yeah, and the sentence was interesting. I mean, this Ray Hemphill was the name of the exorcist at the church that did this. It was in Milwaukee, and you know, basically he was fined, and he spent a little time in jail. But in general, he was not going to be allowed to do exorcisms anymore until he had been formally trained. The implication being that there was a right way to do it, which was, I think, the most frightening part of that whole story.
Did you ever hear whether Ray Hemphill did any more exorcisms after that one?
I don't know that, no.
Huh. Well, that's interesting. So you did it wrong was the
right. Exactly right.
Oh, boy. All right, regulations on exorcism. So there are then? I mean, is there a right way and a wrong way under Wisconsin state law or something to perform an exorcism now?
No.
All right, so let's move on to another practice that might gross a few people out. It's called mezitzah as part of the circumcision process for... is it Orthodox Jews?
Ultra-Orthodox Jews, that's
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm.
So the practice is that after you make the cut, you remove the foreskin, that instead of cleaning the wound with the sterile gauze, which would be the right way to do it, you actually, the moyel, which is the person who does the ritual circumcision, actually sucks the blood off with his mouth. I mean, if he's infected with herpes simplex virus in his mouth, which, you know, can occur asymptomatically, which is to say you wouldn't know you were shedding that virus, then that child can develop the herpes, which can be severe and occasionally fatal. So there's been around 14 children who have suffered either fatal herpes simplex infections or had permanent brain damage when the herpes virus spread to the brain. We see this occasionally in our hospital. We just saw this about maybe 4 or 5 months ago, because you know, we're in Philadelphia, and Lakewood, New Jersey, which is northern New Jersey, has a huge ultra-Orthodox community. So does Brooklyn, New York. There are probably 10, more than, I would say probably more than 10,000 of these procedures performed every year in the United States.
So okay, so if you can't mandate, for example, or and there's still some legal disagreement about that, the practices or how parents are going to get or not seek medical help for their kids, you can at least, it seems like, if they're going to do certain practices like circumcision, you can certainly mandate the sterility of the instruments, some of the sub practices within that, can't you?
Yeah, well, certainly there's no safe way to clean off an open wound with your mouth. So I mean, you can certainly outlaw that. And we do, you know, although the First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion or the practice thereof, we do have laws that restrict the practice of religion. I mean, one is that you're not allowed to deny your child a life-saving blood transfusion if you're a Jehovah's Witness. If you're a fundamentalist Mormon, you're not allowed to practice polygamy. This is going to the Supreme Court in the 1860s. And if you're a member of the Native American Church and you believe that smoking peyote, which is mescaline, gets you closer to your creator, if that violates drug laws, which it invariably does, peyote is mescaline, which is a Schedule I drug, you're not allowed to do that. So we do actually have laws regarding the restriction of certain religious practices. And in a better world, Moyles would not be allowed to suck off that wound with their mouth, knowing that they could hurt the child. And Bloomberg tried to regulate that in New York City. He said at least you have to get a consent form, you have to provide educational materials, and then Bill de Blasio recently just stepped back and said, no, you don't have to do that because he wants to maintain trust in the community. Now, if a Moyle is shown to have infected a child with herpes, then he doesn't get to do that procedure again. And so again, the first child gets grandfathered in to be hurt, which I just think is ridiculous.
We have a call that Karen from Mount Shasta dropped off. She wasn't real specific. She talked about a cancer treatment case where they made one girl come back and have treatment when they fled the state a couple of months ago. Does that case sound familiar to you?
Yeah, there was a case again also in Ohio with a child who was 11, whose actually parents were Amish, and they did mention God in their discussion, that they didn't want chemotherapy for a child that had probably an 85% chance of surviving her particular acute lymphoblastic lymphoma, but the parents chose alternative medicines, you know, sort of dietary supplements instead, and the courts ultimately went along with the parents there, which I think was just the wrong decision. And part of the ruling was that, you know, that they couldn't guarantee 100% success with the chemotherapy, but 85% seems better than 0% that would be offered by those dietary supplements. And frankly, no therapy is 100% effective. I mean, treating meningitis isn't 100% effective, but you're far better off with the antibiotics than without. So I never understood that ruling. Her name was Sarah Hirschberger, was the name of the child.
But I'm sorry. So I guess what we're looking for then is percentages here. If there are places where you might side with the parents in that situation, if maybe the child had a 50% or less chance of surviving with chemotherapy, if that would present a different kind of question to you.
Well, you know, a 50% I still think is better than 0%. I think when you talk about the cancers for which there's very little to offer. I mean, so for example, brainstem gliomas or glioblastomas of the brain. I mean, medicine has very little to offer there. Those are essentially death sentences. I think that a parent could reasonably say, you know, I don't want my child to have to go through all this. I think that's fair, independent of whether you use a religious or just moral argument. But I mean, that's really not what I'm talking about in this book. I'm talking about situations in which the treatments are clear.
You do spend some time talking about abortion in the book, Bad Faith. Why is the discussion of it called the Dialogue of the Deaf?
Because I think neither side hears what the other side is saying. And you know, it's interesting. I sort of came around on this, too. I'm pro-choice. I think it's the mother's right to decide. But it really comes down to sort of that ethical decision, which is unanswerable to me. You know, how do you weigh relatively the rights of the mother, I mean, an actual person, versus the rights of a potential person? But there is no denying the fact that, you know, once an egg is fertilized with a sperm, that it has a full complement of human genetic material. It certainly has the capacity to be a long-lived life. I mean, I see it from the standpoint of the Catholics who believe abortion is essentially murder. It's not my personal belief, but I do see that. So what I focused on in the book, and maybe I just took the easy way out, was that those situations where the mother's life is clearly in danger, where the choice is saving one life, i.e. the mother's, or no lives, and even there the Catholic Church has pulled up short, then that's where I come down hard, I guess, on the Church in that one particular scenario.
And this scenario, it did in fact happen at St. Joseph's Medical Center in Phoenix in 2009. So what was happening with that mother and that child?
Right. So she had pulmonary hypertension, which is to say her heart was failing because of her pregnancy. And you know, it was early in the pregnancy. There was no saving the child. And she was going to die. She was mother of four. I mean, fortunately, Mary McBride, who was the nurse in charge of that decision, decided to do that, for which she was initially excommunicated, as was the hospital. This was in Phoenix. The one that really upset me was this case in Ireland, Savita Halapanavar, the woman's name, who actually wasn't Catholic, but that she was being taken care of in a Catholic hospital, and they would not remove the fetal contents, even though clearly there had been a severe infection that centered on that. And without doing so-called source control, that she was going to die. And then they refused to do it until they couldn't hear the fetal heartbeat anymore. And by then it was too late, and she died of an overwhelming bacterial infection. And the result was that they changed the law, that Edna Kenny, you know, the prime minister in Ireland, changed the law because of that case. And I think it's too bad she had to be sacrificed in order for that to happen.
So, which brings us back around to the religion part of things. You write of Jesus' own views on disease as expressed in the Bible. What did you find there?
Yeah, so there are actually several sentences or places where he says in three of the four Gospels that if you're sick, go to a doctor. And this was, you know, obviously, you know, around between, he lived between 4 BC and 30 AD, so, you know, doctors didn't have a lot to offer. But he did say that. I mean, he didn't, at least in those sentences, see himself as the only person one should turn to when you're sick. It's funny. In reading through the New Testament, I was very much impressed by this man. He was a breakthrough figure, Jesus of Nazareth. I mean, independent of whether you see him as a deity, he as described in the New Testament, he was a breakthrough figure with regard to his treatment of children, and that's why I find this also amazing that the parents of that 1991 epidemic said Jesus was my doctor. I don't think that's the way he would have seen it.
Well, and here again, I mean, Jesus and the way he viewed children is some of the basis for our child welfare laws now.
Exactly right. I mean, so Constantine was the first Christian emperor of Rome, and what he did in 315 and 321 AD is he passed laws to protect children from abuse, passed laws to protect them from being indigent, and as a result, that led to, you know, Christian relief societies for the next 1,800 years.
It's not always an easy read, but it sure is a compelling one. Bad Faith: When Religious Belief Undermines Modern Medicine. Dr. Paul Offit wrote it. Paul, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Jeffrey.